So we left off on Thursday after talking probably at too great a length about libraries and librarians and sexy librarians and all those kinds of things. Yes, I got sex in there again. After talking about all that stuff, we moved to what I call the crisis of information overload. And indeed, to recharacterize this once again, what we see happening with the emergence of the multi-unit corporation in the last quarter of the 19th century is that indeed, as corporate organizational forms, and one can say this about government as well, as organizations grew larger and larger and subdivided their tasks into functional divisions and that sort of thing in the late 19th century, the information handling problem got worse and worse and worse. Now, what I alleged on Thursday is that re-architecting the firm and re-architecting the bureaucracy away from the ma-and-pa, high-touch, hands-on, owner-as-manager kind of model that you still have, shall we say, in your average, I don't know, corner grocery store, provided it's not a franchise, like our famous party stores that only Michigan seems to have. Once they moved out of that model, ideally you can well understand that the organizational chart, that pyramid that the Catholic Church, the Army, basically every formal organization has, that in theory, if the information flows are mapped to the hierarchy itself, then things are still hunky-dory. That is, if you have congruency between the structure and the information flow, you do very, very well. But then we have to rethink for a moment that indeed, that why were those pyramids built in the first place? Why did we end up with those tree-shaped organizational charts? Well, there would be chalk if there were chalk. Say again? Thank you. You've got this in your notes, so I won't. See, this is why we run out of chalk very quickly. Right, we've got these trees that do all this. Right, nice conceptually. Why was this developed? Well, if you look at the genesis of it, where it actually started, it started in the Prussian army. Started in the Prussian army in the late 1800s. And you can imagine why you have an organization chart like this for the military. This way, you can make sure that at this level, you know, you're, say, at the Battle of Waterloo or whatever, you can make sure that your artillery isn't firing on your own infantry, right? This way, you have a hierarchic chain of command, so the person up here is saying, okay, we're going to do this, and the artillery people here and the infantry people here are all aligned, so the artillery people aren't shooting at the infantry people. It does turn out that still, historically, roughly 15 to 20% of all combat deaths are from friendly fire, even to this day. Nonetheless, this organizational chart, or this organizational model, was built by the Prussian Army precisely to avoid things like friendly fire. It was also developed to avoid, to implement accountability. As you have more highly articulated organizational forms, you need to have very clear paths of authority, very clear paths of responsibility, so that anybody in an organizational chart can look up and know exactly where she stands. Spouse, for a number of years, worked in the New York State cultural ed in the archives division, and she looked at her organization chart, and between her and the governor, she was a highly paid manager, between her and the governor there were only, four other levels of management, and she had a level of management below her, and then the people who actually did the work were at level number 7 of the New York State bureaucracy. This is not uncommon. So if it's about accountability, if it's about functional precision, it makes a lot of sense. As I pointed out on Thursday, however, it has some downsides because it precludes organizational flows horizontally across the system. Remember how earlier I was talking about the democracy of a peer-to-peer system, right? That knowledge, beginning with the Scientific Revolution and the Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th centuries, was built on people talking as peers to each other and developing new knowledge. What this does is it largely throws that model out the window and says new knowledge has to be verified through every level of the hierarchy. Again, so if you're looking at General Motors, for example, you'll have the product development people here not talking with the salespeople over here. They don't have the information flows aligned. So what we see happening, and I'll talk about this a little more later, what we see happening, particularly in the last third of the 20th century, is that this organizational form really begins to backfire. American corporations had put these in place, they became ossified, they became dusty, dry, and desiccated. And indeed, American corporations simply were not flexible enough, they were not nimble enough, they couldn't make decisions fast enough to operate in a very information and communications intense global economy. The solution to that, I'll get to later, but the solution to that, to flatten out organizations, organizational flattening was a big buzzword from about 85 to 95. Flattening it out for a while seemed to work, but by moving toward more peer-to-peer structures, one lost the notion of accountability, one screwed up the information flows, and indeed we're still in rather a mess today. I'll talk about that more as we go along. Another thing we see happening within American business is the information professional of this organizational form, the high bureaucracy of the 20th century. The true information professional in an office setting was, of course, the secretary. This was a, obviously, 95% of the time, these were women. They were oftentimes as much decor. And if you look at the films from the 1950s, you see this quite a bit. They were as much decor and rewards for high-performing executives, with perhaps a promise of sex on the side. Yeah, I got to sex again. With a promise of sex on the side. There were all kinds of lewd novels and movies in the 50s about executives who had actually made it, and their prize is a nice, nubile, svelte secretary who was sexually available. This is quite a change from the information professional before this organizational form. The informational professional then, of course, was the male clerk working in his ledger books, a guy who could rise through the bureaucracy. The characteristic of the secretary is that her job throughout much of the 20th century had a very, very solid piece of glass plate for a ceiling. That is, there were not 18 million cracks possible in that glass ceiling, and indeed virtually no women made it through. In other words, the social mobility, the dynamics of social mobility of people being able to work up through the organization became very, very gendered. And indeed, the importance of the secretary's work, because it was done by women, tended to be systematically devalued. And if you actually work in a bureaucracy, work with secretaries, you begin to recognize very quickly that they are the repositories of organizational knowledge. They're the repositories of internal strategy, who's friends with whom. They know all of the good gossip. And in fact, these formal organizations, in large part, ignore the fact that gossip, coffee machine chatter, that sort of thing, is one of the driving forces in an organization. In other words, the gender of the secretary basically trumped the value of the information that she carried. And indeed, symbolically, I think, not to be too technologically deterministic about it, to me, one of the symbols that really hits home is the typewriter. The typewriter was invented roughly in the 1870s. It obviously, as you know, facilitated the rapid and standardized presentation of text. And importantly, I remember doing research on this years ago. When typewriters were first being rolled out, they would have ads for secretarial schools. Again, this gets back to the librarian problem I mentioned before. What does a well-educated woman, in this case not the college-educated woman who became the nurse, the librarian, or the teacher, but instead the high school-educated woman, what does she do that is not nasty, ugly factory work, where a married woman could do work and her husband would not worry about his masculinity being threatened by transgressions on his wife. So what we see is that secretarial work becomes the most common form of white-collar work, actually called pink-collar work by the middle of the 20th century because it was so gendered. I love the metaphor that was used. I looked at the ads for the secretarial schools roughly 100 years ago, and they would basically say, aha, you know how to play the piano because all women of a certain social standing knew how to play the piano, right? If you bought music in 1900, you didn't buy recorded music, you bought sheet music. And who played the sheet music but women? Good middle-class women from all over the country were taught how to play the piano. And so the ads for the secretarial schools would say, well, you know how to play the piano, so of course you know how to play the typewriter. And that sort of bait and switch was a very queer sort of process that helped to regender the information trades in the early 20th century. At the same time, we see the burgeoning of the volume of records, whether it's sales records coming from the marketing division, whether it's production records coming from very careful, after 1910 roughly, very careful analyses of production flows, of goods flows, whether it's the purchasing stuff, we're seeing mountains and mountains of paperwork coming through. Now, corporations, of course, under the law, are individuals. That is, corporations are treated as humans. They have full standing in court. They can own things. They can be sued. The owners of them have incorporation, so to speak, means never having to say you're sorry. That is, if you have a manager and he misbehaves, it's the corporation who's liable, not the owners of the corporation who are liable. It's a way of, as they call it, limited liability, the famous LTD that you see initialed after British corporate names. What this meant then is that the privacy rights of corporations became essentially equivalent to the privacy rights of individuals. And just as nobody has a right to look at my bank accounts, we as citizens don't have any right to look at the accounts of General Motors, despite the fact that General Motors' decisions mean prosperity or desperation for the Michigan economy. They are not accountable to the public. Why? Because despite the fact of being a very core part of our society here in Michigan, they are private persons and not accountable. By contrast, political organizations and governmental organizations have to be transparent. They have to be accountable. And indeed, if you look at the way cities like New York were run under the Boss Tweed crowd in the late 19th century, or little towns like Wasilla, Alaska were run in the last couple years, all done by arm's length relationships, everything being done under the table, under the QT, no transparency, no nothing, no records discovery, no ability of the citizens to hold them accountable, we began to see by about 1905, 1910, demands that they be held accountable and that there be records reporting, that the public have a right to know. This was the core of what the progressive movement was all about. Progressive movement was very big in Wisconsin, Minnesota, somewhat less so here in Michigan, but a very, very important piece of it. I should mention, on the notion of transparency, let me ask a question just in passing, because it's, you know, when we're talking about transparency of public records, how many of you think government emails are records, that they should be subject to public scrutiny? How many people think, well, it's nobody's business what the governor is sending out over the text messaging, right? That's not email, but it is, you know, owned by the city, the text messaging. You think that should be closed? Really? Okay. Even if in the text messaging somebody's saying, hey, we get a good kickback on this contract if we set it up with this sewer contractor as opposed to this one, or maybe we should fire this head of the highway patrol because he refused to fire my sister's ex, which is the current scandal. In other words, I would argue, yeah, you had a question? Who's to decide what nobody... Did everybody hear the question? Maybe it should be selective. It should only be significant correspondence.
Sometimes make a huge difference that people would care about, like changing taxes or, you know, something like that. And if they're doing something in public, they're doing something secret under the table, then we should know about that.
Yeah. Yeah, please. Exactly. We could talk about the Detroit mayor. We could talk about, again, the Sarah Palin thing of firing the head of the state troopers because he wouldn't fire her sister's ex. Is that a significant decision? Probably not, but in an election season, we use that as a way to read the character of the candidate, right? So it's probably important, though the impact of that decision was minimal, certainly to anybody outside the state of Alaska, it's completely zero, but it does reflect something about a candidate for office that I think it behooves us to know. In other words, we have notions of transparency that I think need to be very clear and very codified. And indeed, it wasn't until 1936 that we finally saw after a long period of codifying standards for record keeping, we finally saw the emergence of the National Archives, that is, a national repository for all of the records generated by the federal government. Now, lest you think that records transparency is a rule within the federal government, even in the more sleepy bureaucracies like the Department of Interior, I beg you to note for a moment the so-called Cobell case, C-O-B-E-L-L. Ms. Cobell, I believe, is a Blackfoot Indian. She recognized that under the late 19th century treaties that sort of sealed the genocide of the Indian and put them all in the concentration camps that we call reservations, that the Great White Father in Washington was going to manage Indian assets for those Indians because as primitive children, obviously, they weren't capable in the government eyes to doing it themselves. So in essence, the Department of Interior became the contracting agent for the timber, for the oil, for the gas, for the minerals, for the resources, et cetera, on the Indian reservations. They did the contracts with the oil companies and mining companies, et cetera, and had a big trust fund and were supposed to pay this money back to the Indians. Well, nobody knows where the money went. Not only does nobody know where the money went, there aren't any records. Some of the records were found in flooded basements and rented office space in Washington. And this is big time stuff. A decision came down, very unfortunately, that said, well, the feds only owe them $5 billion, the upper limit of what they owed them. This is 100 years worth of resource sales plus interest. The upper limit is probably something closer to $500 billion. Do we know? No, because they didn't actually keep the records. So let's look at your basic hierarchy. This is your standard org chart. I needn't give it much more explanation because we're running, as usual, short on time. But let me underline very clearly, however, that any organizational structure reflects what's supposedly an objective analysis of how an organization should work. And granted, most corporations use this structure. Most corporations use this structure because they inherited it over the generations. And for the most part, it's pretty straightforward. You know, you get finance in one division, marketing in another division, operations in another division, etc. This kind of makes sense. Nonetheless, these organizational forms, again, once they become inherited, once they get practiced and performed through several generations, they become barriers to change. They become barriers to readaptation. And even more, like any organizational framework, they carry a lot of cultural presuppositions within them. Notice that under the standard corporate chart developed and implemented through the 19th century, you didn't have a division called eco-friendliness or pollution minimization or reducing the carbon footprint. That division never existed. Because it never existed, that was never considered a proper function of a corporation. You simply don't worry about those things. When we try to bring those considerations in, how do we make it work? Now, we see what the federal government does with this. Anytime we get a new crisis over something like, say, terrorists fly planes into a building, we say, let's create a new division called Homeland Security. Right? You create yet another level of hierarchy up here at this level here below the placeholder up at the top, president under the charge of the vice president. Yeah.
An example I find really interesting is that there's no Department of Culture in the United States.
Exactly.
In many countries.
Most countries, very good, Dominique. Most countries have at the level with defense, veterans affairs, homeland security, they have a Ministry of Culture. And it makes sense. I was paid by the French Ministry of Culture for a while myself. It's a cool organization. They fund libraries, museums. They come up with a cultural vision as to where, what sort of things that they'd like to fund and where culture should move. You know, should we be subsidizing Britney Spears and her French clones, or should we be subsidizing opera? And you can see the obvious American critique of this. If we have a Ministry of Culture, it will be making choices about taste, and it will be telling us that Toby Keith really is sort of a dunderhead. And, you know, for the people who love Toby Keith and NASCAR, sorry, that ain't culture, that's trash, right? They're making all kinds of value judgments. Be that as it may, one can, again, these are legitimate questions, but they're legitimate questions within the framework of organizational structures that I think are very, very perilous at this point. Because, in fact, they do represent the cultural, social, and political presuppositions of higher and lower, how you should organize things. It gets back to the old Dewey Decimal System, which is indeed a hierarchy very much like this, a hierarchy that Dewey used to organize knowledge, inherited from Buffon, people like Buffon who used it to organize species, or Carl Linnaeus who used it to organize all life forms, etc., or Diderot and D'Alembert who used it to organize all kinds of human knowledge. The question then becomes, okay, there's a presupposition here. Let me work on this for a minute because it's an intriguing idea. There's a presupposition here that any actor in this system, any person within this hierarchy, can only occupy a unique place, right? Because we think of, okay, this is where your desk is. This might not be the physical map of the building, but this is where your desk is. Does that make sense? Now, this is true when we're talking about physical objects. Right, your desk can only be in one place. You can only be in one place personally at one time, unless you're really doing strong drugs, right? How can you be in two places at once when you're not anywhere at all? Maybe that was a Sesame Street song? Probably not. But the idea with physical location is that it has to be unique. If we classify something in a library, if we have a physical library book, it has to have a unique location. But if it's a digital object, we don't have to do that anymore. If it's a digital object, like my book on the French Power Company, if it's a digital volume, it can be set in a classification hierarchy that would put it under engineering, under labor studies, under political economy, under technology studies. It can be in all of those locations at once. And we can get rid of the hierarchy, flatten everything out, and you're used to this on a day-to-day basis when you use Google. Google has completely flat linking. So indeed, if I have, in the virtual museum project I did this summer, if I have an article on fishing, you know, what were they fishing? Well, fishing up around the Sioux, right? Done by Native Americans. That can be, classified as cultural activity, because fishing is part of Ojibwe culture. It can be classified as part of sustenance and gathering food, which is clearly what it is. It can also be classified as treaty rights, because there are very powerful treaty rights that the Ojibwe of Northern Michigan gained under the Treaty of 1836 that were largely ignored until the 1970s. Became a very big political issue. My point here, then, is that we can begin to think of what I like to call a post-colonial or a post-hierarchical system of organizing knowledge and information. Indeed, we can begin to think about doing that with humans and organizations, where indeed I, as a faculty member, can be both within the School of Information and maybe in another department and have other functions here and there and there and there. I should mention in passing that when the University of Michigan redid its administrative computing infrastructure that gave you such wonderful items as our friends at Wolverine Access, don't we love Wolverine Access? When PeopleSoft redesigned it, they were still working from this framework. So we have an architecture, and you get the feel of it, and I'm not going to pursue this too much, you get the feel working in Wolverine Access that you're working in some little leg of a huge system that's hierarchically formed like this, and that the information doesn't flow across the legs of the tree. Legs of the tree? Trees don't have legs. The branches of the trees particularly well. I've got to keep my metaphors coherent here, if nothing else. So we run into all kinds of problems when PeopleSoft was redoing administrative computing here. Indeed, they ended up scratching their heads for months and months on end because they had done corporate organizational computing. They had never done academic. And if you're, evidently the standard model is if you're in a corporate organization, you have one job title and only one job title. In academics, you can have multiple job titles within the same institution, and PeopleSoft goes, you can't do that! You've got to be in one box here and no other boxes! And it took months banging away with these people to say, well, we don't have to be in boxes at all. Another way to get the grip on the information overload of the 20th century was through information science and the mechanization and later computerization of information handling, obviously, what we're supposed to be talking about this week. We saw, for example, the 1900 census was the first census that was tabulated mechanically using punch cards. How many of you have ever seen punch cards? Probably still a few of you. How many of you have never seen this? Good. Interesting. Artifacts of the past. I took all of my dissertation notes on the back of unpunched punch cards because they were much cheaper than note cards, and I could buy boxes of 3,000. When I first got to Paris, I wasn't going to bring a whole box of 3,000 cards with me, so I needed note cards, and I went to the computing centers at various universities. I ended up at Paris, and I said, I want a box of these little cards, and they say, well, do you want access rights to a punch machine? I go, no, I just want the cards. What do you want the cards for? And I said, to write on them. And they go, my God, you're going to write on punch cards? Yeah. In any case, it became understood with insurance companies, with the Census Bureau, with the 1900 census, that once one starts assembling information in machine-readable form, one can do analysis of that information and, again, come up with new knowledge. And indeed, this was the core of the emerging discipline called information science, with its flagship journal, the JSIS, Journal of the American Society of Information Science. Another vector goes less toward the database approach, than the communications approach at dealing with information and information organization and filtering. And that's the famous Shannon and Weaver paper of the 1940s. Imagine yourself doing radio intelligence for the Allies during the Second World War, or as it were, doing radio intelligence for NATO during the Cold War. You've got a lot of signals out there, right? Do you really care to capture the signal about, the Prime Minister going to Athens and ordering dinner? Do you really care? If you care about national security, not so much. You've got an awful lot of what we call noise. So the challenge to Shannon and Weaver, and this comes straight out of radio. If you've ever listened to AM radio, how many of you have ever heard AM radio? Does any? Okay, some people still listen to it. What you run into is you get, I remember, living in the Deep South, the only good rock and roll I could hear was in the Deep South was WLS out of Chicago. And we could get that late at night, but it was kind of like, oh, I can almost hear the song, if it's raining, because there was a lot of noise. I wanted to get the signal, and I had to use my own head to pull the signal from the noise. This is what Shannon and Weaver started developing, all kinds of very sophisticated mathematical algorithms. Shannon at the time, was working at Bell Labs up in New Jersey. Very useful, and indeed this became the foundation for what we called SIGINT, signals intelligence, that's still done quite a bit today. I've already talked about labels and meanings, and I think this is my last major slide on this module. Going back to some of the concepts I introduced at the very beginning of the course, information is, in some sense, about control. It's about having data doubles, having surrogates of humans that are made up of information, that if we have enough information on an individual, somehow we can know who that individual is. Can be used as systems of control. We all, if you go across a border, you have to have a document called a passport that gets stamped. That's a way of keeping information and power aligned. One of my favorite stories of this was, of course, the Hollerith company. Hollerith was the punch card company that IBM bought roughly about 1900. And IBM was a huge vendor of Hollerith machines to insurance companies, various other corporate bodies, to the Census Bureau, etc. The Nazis obviously needed to do some very powerful information filtering. The Nazis had to figure out who were good Germans and who were Jews, who were members of degraded populations that should be exterminated, and who were good Germans who should be encouraged to reproduce, sometimes in clinical settings. Well, how did they do this? They needed a way to handle information on the entire German population and the entire population of immigrants within Germany, in particular Jews who had fled from Eastern Europe as fascism emerged in Eastern Europe, places like Romania, Hungary, much earlier. So by the mid-1930s, the Nazi government had a serious information problem on their hands. How do you make sure that you're not shipping good Germans to the extermination camps? How do you track that information? You track it using punch cards. You track it using punch cards sold to you by IBM. Indeed, IBM is deeply, deeply compromised by its relationship with the Nazis during the Second World War. Not quite as, it's far worse than Apple making chips for the Predator, but, one's hands do get dirty. I'll skip this takeaways because you can read it yourselves and there's no need for me to repeat what I've already said. Okay, line across the paper. We're starting week three material, and we're only an hour into week three, so we're not doing too badly. So, what I'm going to try to get to here, let me do a quick survey. I think I did this before, but I'll do it again. What's an API? How many people know what an API is? smattering, not too bad. How many people know the difference between bitmaps and vector graphics? Small number. Okay. I know you know, Jason. You don't have to raise your hand. That's why I hired you, because you know this stuff. What I'm going to try to do in this module is get you confident on knowing those terms. You're not going to come out of this being a computer scientist, obviously. But hopefully, you will be able to, in some way, reconfigure the power relationships around the machines that you deal with every day. How many of you end up, as my sister does, it's not my sister, my brother-in-law, it won't work, and they start banging on it, and they start screaming at it, and they just go nuts, and then my phone rings. Bob, it doesn't work. And this is, you know, she's my older sister, and she still says, doesn't work. And so I have to explain it to her. But because she's my sister, I don't say, as many IT support people are reputed to say, oh, you're just a dumb girl. You don't know what you're talking about. Shut up. Right? How many women in this room have been dissed when you ask an answer to a technical question? Only one? Two? You can admit it. It's not that bad. It's not about you. It's about the people who are being such jerks. So what I'm trying to get across is to, I already have the questions up here, is sort of get across the basics so you don't feel like complete and utter fools. And maybe you'll get a leg up and maybe even get interested. There's a lot of change going on. Obviously, things change quite a bit. But frankly, with the exception of things that are happening on the internet, most of what we know about computers and computational systems, these little boxes that we have, fundamentally those haven't changed in kind very much in a few years now, and probably over a decade. We still have the basic architecture, the basic same configuration. Things are changing very fast up at the very top with networked information, networked applications, cloud computing, things like that. But fortunately, we've seen stabilization at the level of computers themselves and operating systems, which should make this a little easier for you to pick up on and me to teach than it was when I first started teaching this course. We'll talk about standards quite a bit. We'll talk about the implications of computer architecture for business models. We'll talk about infrastructures, what we need to make these things work, etc. So what are the goals? We'll talk about cost issues, issues of technological choice, that is, what system do you use to do certain tasks? I never cease to be amazed that many of us go out and buy these very fancy computers like this that can push bits around and do all kinds of heavy computational tasks. Remember that my little iPod Touch here has more computational power than the Apollo spaceship had when humans landed on the moon. Is that a hand? No, that's a head scratch. You know, I've got more power here on my belt loop than, you know, they had in the Apollo space mission. So we'll talk about that. Why do we always buy overpowered machines? Do we have the option to buy lesser powered machines? And yes, we do, but the cognitive overload for doing it is considerable. One thing I'm going to look at very closely are issues of bottlenecks, both within the functioning of computers and computer systems and within the context of business plans that parallel those. We'll talk about open systems, open standards, proprietary systems, proprietary standards, patents, as much as I dislike them. I'm going to talk more about patents under a separate rubric, don't worry. I'm going to make a distinction between open source and open standards, which is no doubt going to confuse everybody. Then we'll talk somewhat about the social implications of it. On the one hand, cognitive communities, electronically networked communities of like thinkers, whether they're all dope smokers or Toby Keith fans or Sarah Palin fans. They have their own networks. And we can talk about some of the promising future of computers that think on their own and can, on their own, unbeknownst to us, crash an entire sector, the financial sector. So let's define digital. Digital is very simple. It's yes and no. It's binary. It's on or off. There are no questions of degree. It's on or off. How many of you did truth tables in high school? Those little grids, true, false, you know, if this is true, false, you know, little 2x2 squares or whatever you call them. Pretty much anything can be represented by a very long string of yes-nos, right? We know 20 questions. You know, 20 questions basically gives you a tree to follow down so that you can, by asking 20 yes-no questions, you can actually learn an awful lot by just following a vector down. I'm oversimplifying, but you can think of binary as working that way. It's not about metaphors. It's not about more or less. It's about yes or no. This is not the world we as humans live in. We live in an analog world. Our bodies live in an analog world. We don't think hot or cold. I know there is that website Hot or Not still out there? Remember that? I don't even know if it's out there. But even that gave you levels of degree, right? On a scale of 1 to 10, right, he's a 4. So even that was in notions of degree. What do I mean by notions of degree? When we hear sound, we can hear soft sounds, or we can hear large sounds, and it's all about the height, the amplitude of the sound wave, how much energy is being put into it. More energy gives you higher amplitude for the same frequency of sound. Again, degree. Language is full of all kinds of subtlety, of degree, of shades of meaning. One of the things I really appreciated in learning French many years ago is that it's a language that I think is very consciously built around degree, ambiguity, shadings, keeping things a little mysterious, which makes French romance so much fun. Images are also about analog perception. More or less blue, more or less red. And we do this very sophisticated analog processing in our own heads at blazingly rapid rates. So digital can be very accurate, but to be definitive, it gets very, very busy. Let's think of musical reproduction. Musical reproduction, as far as we know, seems to have started sometime probably in the late 1860s, mid to late 1860s. My understanding, I think I had a version of it once, is that Chopin actually played, what was it, the Minute Etude or the Minute Waltz? Anybody know? Say what? I think it was a waltz.
It was a waltz.
It was a waltz. And he played that, and it's actually recorded. There actually is a recording of Chopin playing that on some incredibly early sound reproduction device. Yeah, it surfaced about 15, 20 years ago. Pretty cool to hear Chopin himself playing his own music. I know, it's almost as good as hearing Toby. No, I'm not going to go there again. Beating that one to death today. But it's not like hearing Britney Spears playing her own music, but she lip syncs, and they fix it in real time while she's doing it. But if you think about analog recording technology, it's all about direct reproduction. Literally, the way it works is in the early versions, it would have a big horn to capture the air, to capture the sound waves and focus them onto a target, which turned out to be a needle, which would press harder or softer as it fed its way down a cylinder. So if it was pressing harder for more energy, louder sound, it would press harder. If indeed
the frequency was higher. It would do it at a higher frequency, but not nearly as deeply. And that's exactly what we want. Right? And that all got directly reproduced. Genius technology, when you think about it, and a very robust one. It lasted for roughly a century because it did work very well, and there could be incremental improvements. One could get greater and greater fidelity by switching from wax to something made out of ants, if I recall. Bakelite for a while, various other substances, finally ended up on vinyl before pretty much the end of the CD, the end of the LP in the 1980s. But then when you think about CDs, what an incredible headache. This is an incredibly complicated way to reproduce sound. How do you do it? Very simply. Imagine you've got a sound wave. This is Baby Hit Me Again, or whatever the song is. Right? Sound wave. We've all seen these sound waves, right? How do you do it? Well, you have T down here on your x-axis, and you sample it. You sample it for amplitude and frequency at a given sampling rate. Does that make sense? So at each moment, you have a sample of what the sound is. What happens if you have a low sample rate? You still get sound, but it's going to be pretty cruddy. It's going to sound like an old scratchy telephone. Actually, it'll be clean, so you won't get static. It will just be really cruddy. Anybody ever hear download music at a very low bit rate, like a 32 kbps bit rate? Sounds like crap, right? Compared to like a 192 or a 320, 256, or better yet, a lossless, right? Which sounds very, very good. That's all because of the sample rate, right? So the higher the sample rate, the higher the fidelity because you're capturing more samples, okay? Makes perfect sense from a statistical standpoint. Similarly, if you're thinking of a camera, how many of you have taken a picture with your camera phone and then tried to blow it up to about this big on your screen? What happens?
That's called
blah. Exactly, that's a perfect expression. Looks dreadful. Why? Because you haven't gotten enough samples of that field. You haven't literally gotten enough dots sampled, enough pixels, picture elements as they're called. You don't have enough sample points. So when you stretch it out, it looks like crap. So we have, my point here is that digital can be very, very accurate and can be entirely noiseless. As we know, a digital copy is as good as the original. It's not like when I was in college and we used to share music by passing around cassettes. You should try the 10th generation version of Jimi Hendrix on a cassette tape. You think an old telephone sounds bad, this you can barely get anything, right? Dreadful, because each new generation of an analog copy, a copy of a copy of a copy, gets progressively worse because it multiplies those problems. Another thing that we do, and I think analog brains are very good at saying this is kind of like that, rather than saying this is that or this is not that. We are very, very good at absolutely rapid processing of subtlety. It means that we can see things and recognize things very quickly. We can recognize faces like that unbelievably fast. Experimental psychologists never cease to be amazed at how quick our brains can process that analog information. Take, for example, this image here. Now, I won't ask what she's doing, he's doing, it's doing with its left paw. how long did it take any of us to recognize that that's a cat? To do even have any wag? It was like, well, of course it's a cat. Bang, it's a cat. Zero processing time. Now, if we are the Department of Homeland Security and we're trying to look for fat white cats, and we have a video camera up there, we have to have a sample of all of the possibilities of what fat white cats might look like. There's a joke there somewhere, but I won't go there. You might have a database, and so you send, you take your picture of the fat white cat and you run it through a database of a million different possibilities of what fat white cats might look like, and if it absolutely perfectly aligns, then you've got it. Imagine how busy that is. If you teach a computer to recognize this cat sitting in this position, and the cat moves, then it will no longer recognize the cat. We can recognize a cat, not because it's necessarily rule-based. I don't think our brains even work that way. But let's just say, provisionally, our brains are rule-based and say, well, we recognize cats because they've got triangles on their heads and a long tail, and they say meow. Well, let's just leave the triangles and the tail. Distinctive features, are there any? Well, okay, other kinds of felines, but triangles on their heads and the tail. Now, if the cat is lying down where we can only see one triangle instead of two, then we're in a dilemma under that rule-based system, right? You follow our logic here? This can get very, very tricky. We are incredibly good at this. So we have advantages and disadvantages of going digital. As I pointed out, digital reproduction is precise. The higher the sample rate, the better the reproduction. It's noiseless. There is no such thing as a distinction between an original and a copy. When you have, you know, if you're using a Sony CyberShot camera and you take a picture and it's in your machine, I guess that's original. Is it still the original when you move that over to your machine? I don't know. It's identical, so it doesn't matter, right? A digital copy is perfect, well-defined, cleanly calculable and reproducible. At the same time, it's incredibly busy, incredibly computationally intensive. Let me point out computationally intensive here for a moment. The sample rate on your standard audio CDs is 44.2, isn't it? Cycles per second, 1,000 cycles per second? 44.2? That's literally how many samples it takes, 44,200 44,200 samples per second. Why is it set at 44.2? Because when the CD standard was developed by Sony and Philips, in the late 70s and early 80s, that's as fast as the processors of the 1980 generation could work. We could have CDs today with much, much higher sample rates and theoretically get much better reproduction. Most people would say, I can't hear it, particularly if you're over 50, you can't hear it. We could do that, but we're stuck with that sample rate. Why? Because it reflected the computational power of 1980, and it was set in stone as a standard. Imagine trying to market a CD today with a higher sample rate. You tell everybody, okay, throw your CD players away. Here's a new CD. We're doing this with TV next year, right? Throw away your TV. Might be a good idea anyway. Notice we're doing the digital transition after the Super Bowl. My point here, then, is that subtlety is difficult, scalability is difficult, digital is very busy, but it's very precise. Which gets us, I think, to one of the oldest questions in computer science, in computer engineering. For a long time, people put a lot of stock in what was called the Turing test. Alan Turing was a signal intelligence guy working for MI5, I think it's called, British Intelligence, during the Second World War. He was a cryptographer extraordinaire. This guy could do incredibly sophisticated manipulations of messages through all, work them through an equation and get the secret that the Germans are going to go invade Russia or whatever, which they didn't know about before the Russians did it, told the Soviets, and the Soviets said, oh, they'd never do that. But he did. But that's another piece of history. But Alan Turing was really, really a brilliant guy. One of the fathers of modern computing, because it did come out of cryptography. And the Turing test was basically a test that was developed, can we tell the difference between a human and a computer doing some sort of computational process? The goal being that computers have actually become like humans when we can't tell the difference. This is really stupid. Do we want computers to be like humans? Or worse still, do we want humans to be like computers? It is a lousy metaphor. Why? Because brains are really, really, really good at doing subtlety. We can read expressions in zillionths of a second. We can look in somebody's eyes and tell whether it's a lascivious gaze or they just want another cup of coffee. We can pick up on that in a moment. Impossible to get a computer to figure it out that quickly. And why would we want to? You can throw an enormous differential equation at a computer and it'll solve it. How many of us can solve long algebraic formulas in our heads in hundredths of a second? Good, thank you. I'm glad we have one who can. You got a job. CIA's looking for you. So for roughly the first half century of computing, that is, from roughly the Second World War until about the turn of the century, certainly until the early 90s, the gold standard was, can we get computers to act like humans? Until we finally realized, we got a bad history with separate but equal, but maybe this is a place where we might use it. Computers are good at some stuff, humans are good at others. Fine, live with it. Don't keep trying to make computers like humans. This was particularly true in the field called artificial intelligence. That is, developing computers that could draw conclusions from incomplete data, from fuzzy situations, that could interpret things, etc. The promise of artificial intelligence was kind of like the promise of voice recognition or pattern recognition. That is, we were always told that, 5 years from now, the problem will be solved. They were saying that 25 years ago. I remember. I was there. Oh, we'll have robust voice recognition, so you'll just have to talk into a microphone and it will spew it all back as text. Dream on. Sure, we've got systems that are fairly good at it, but it's very, very tricky. Pattern recognition, even more difficult. Pattern recognition is done under the current Homeland Security models. It's done by measuring various distances, distance between pupils, distance between tip of nose, tip of chin, these, cheekbone to cheekbone, et cetera, tip of ear, and then coming up with a great big fancy equation and number that represents those formulas, those relationships, which are all fine and good until somebody turns their head. And then all of those ratios, all of those measurements get screwed up. You follow my logic here? My point, then, is that what happened to artificial intelligence, I think, is very interesting. The large agenda was to get computers to act like humans. Then we began to realize, not so much. But we can have, we can delegate smaller tasks. We can have them do things like a mortgage analysis. So it can look at multiple variables and come up with a weighting algorithm and do a mortgage approval electronically. That's doable. We can have electronic trading where it can judge certain fundamentals about a company, certain movements of other companies within the sector, i.e. we can program in all the variables it's supposed to do, and we can offload our decisions for it, much the same way that that happened with the United Airlines thing I was talking about earlier today. We can do that. But that's a much lower level agenda. And it also raises, once we start having what we call these intelligent agents, which is the sort of fallback agenda for artificial intelligence, once we have intelligent agents, that's fine and good, but are they going to talk with each other? Are they going to be standards compliant? Or are they going to be little fancy hobbies or little fancy high markup products coming out of highly specialized companies? An ecosystem of intelligent agents that could talk with each other is obviously the material of a science fiction film, but it's also something that I think we can see as doable. The only thing is we don't have the business infrastructure, the standards compliance, and the kind of leadership in the IT sector to make that happen. So in any conversation about computing and information, we have to talk about the great laws. These were purportedly the equivalents of F equal MA or E equals MC squared in the computing world. Probably the most frequently mentioned one is Moore's Law, named after Gordon Moore, one of the co-founders of Intel Corporation. He remarked in 1964, I believe it was, that in each 18 months, it was possible to pack twice as many transistors on a piece of silicon than it was 18 months earlier. What the hell does this mean? Let me explain. A CPU, or a central processing unit, is fundamentally, as I said, a bunch of on-off switches. And a set of states represents a particular logical condition. The way CPUs are made, I won't go into the gory details of photolithography, basically it's a way of putting digital switches into silicon, transistors into silicon. The more transistors you have, the more powerful processors you have. How many transistors? Anybody know? Does a current Intel Core Duo have on it? Anybody know this? Say what?
What was the question?
How many transistors does an Intel Core Duo chip have these days? Don't know.
151 million
transistors on one little tiny piece of silicon. What is that, 64 by? I can't remember what the die is. It's about this big. A couple centimeters across. Now, who cares, right? All of these gazillion, million transistors on a piece of silicon, well, it becomes a metaphor. Because it's actually a fairly rough representation of computational power of that processor. So doubling of the number of transistors on silicon every 18 months translates over into the mantra of the industry, the doubling of computer power every 18 months. Vertiginous increases in power. As Bill Gates, I'm not particularly inclined to quote very often, did say circa, 1985, 1990, he said that if airplanes had the technological improvements since the Second World War, he was saying this in the mid-80s, that computers have had, you could fly to London in 5 minutes and it would cost you a dime, which would be nice. I hate to think about the carbon footprint question.
Is there a breaking point in this? Because I thought as technology moves on to reality,
big fear, and this is one reason. Thank you for asking the question. It does seem that in the past few years, you know, it's been doing this, and now we're getting it here. It's starting to flatten out because of the fundamental material science and physics involved. You just can't pack that much stuff in. I guess the constraint is heat dissipation, mostly, because there's always loss in a transistor circuit, and if you have too many packed in too close to each other, it'll just fry itself and die. This is a reason why over the past 4 to 5 years, and we'll talk about this later in this module, in the past 4 or 5 years, most of the major chip manufacturers have gone to multiple processor cores. So when I mentioned the Intel Core Duo, that actually has two computational units on the same piece of silicon. It's not necessarily the best strategy to follow, but it's one that got followed. Yes, this is getting reaching the peak. We thought this was going to happen earlier in silicon. It didn't. We thought it was going to happen earlier in memory storage because, interestingly, Moore's Law holds for processors, that is, doubling of capabilities every 18 months, give or take, right? We're starting to see it flatten out. But it also turns out, and nobody really anticipated this, it also turns out to be true with storage, that is, with hard drive capacity. I remember the first hard drive that I bought it on an NSF grant in 1990, came in a box about this big, and it was a 40 megabyte drive that I paid a mere $375 for. And I thought, wow, this is a bargain, because 6 months earlier, it had been $600 or $700. And I thought, wow, 40 megs, I'll never have to buy a hard drive again. That was about 40 hard drives ago. And now, you know, where is it? Yeah, now I'm going to have 320 gigs on this little sucker that I paid $100 for. Not bad at all. So what Moore's Law, the subtext of Moore's Law, technically speaking, yeah, it's doubling of power 18 months. Generally, whether it's, and that's, again, ballpark. It's a metaphor. It's not actually directly so. But it's a good metaphor. But it's branched out into a lot of other stuff. It's become sort of the magic overarching metaphor for all of IT. Most of you were too young to remember the tech boom of the 1990s. But it was like everybody was really high on acid or something. Because I tell you, the notion was doubling power every 18 months. Boy, if I buy computer stock today, it'll be just vastly more valuable 6 months from now. So we better buy it now, better buy it now. And everybody bids everybody up. And the whole thing went nuts. Not because Moore's Law didn't actually function. It did. What caused the crash? Well, all this technology was going nuts. The engineers were doing a fabulous job. Unbelievably brilliant work. In IT in the 80s, 90s, and into this decade. Brilliant work. The only thing is, businesses would buy them and say, can I play solitaire on this? They had no idea what to do with all that processing power. It was huge. And the machines were less and less expensive every day. But there were technical possibilities out there that simply could not be implemented in the real world in valuable ways. The second law, and I'll close on these last two, is Metcalfe's law. This is to communications, i.e. internet networked information, what Moore's Law is to processing power. Basically, that the value of an information system goes up with the square of the number of users. It's what we call the network effect. Very, very important. Because this does bring in a very important social side to things. It tells us that knowledge is about critical mass. Very, very good, and we're going to touch on this more finally, and I say this with considerable reserve, considerable modesty, what I would call Frost's Law. If Moore's Law is all about burgeoning capacity, possibilities of Metcalfe's law is all about the wealth of networks. Frost's law is that most humans won't avail themselves of it. That indeed, humans do not learn or work or change as fast as technology does. There will always be a lag. And the engineers can put out that cool stuff, and they do. I adore them. I studied them for years. They can do this amazing stuff. And then donuts like us go on and say, can I play solitaire with that? Thanks very much. See you on Thursday.